Hello and welcome to the Hopkins Green Tea, an energy podcast brought to you by the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. My name is Amethyst Devlin, and today I am joined by my co-hosts,
Abigail Hunter,
Shada Hushmandi.
Today we are continuing our Master of series, where we dive a little bit deeper into the capstones that each one of us presented in May when we graduated with our Masters of Sustainable Energy from Johns Hopkins. In the last episode, I discussed building electrification, and in today's episode is the co-host that I got confused with all during our grad school years together. Amethyst, Abigail, the names are very similar. They start with A's, except for I don't know as much about aluminum as Abigail does. So the topic today is Master of Aluminum. And Abigail, we'd love for you to just share a little bit more about what exactly your topic was. And just kick us off there.
For sure. So my capstone was on aluminum, but specifically the intersection of aluminum and national security and the clean energy transition and whether or not those different areas enable one another or undermine one another. And so, you know, in Amethyst's episode, we asked the question about why did you choose this topic? And I chose this topic because, first of all, somebody paid me to do it. And I think that it's really important for any young people, but also especially women, to make sure that like everything you're doing and you're working hard on is being rewarded. And, you know, you're
Get that bag.
Yes, exactly. So just a little plug to say that like you are worth it. I did not know a lot about aluminum going into this. And I was very confident in my skills as a researcher to be able to publish now 4 papers on this topic. And so you can do it too. And happy to talk to people about how to monetize a capstone or thesis for the embetterment of your research and the people that ultimately get to read it. So that was kind of the backstory. I also chose the aluminum topic because I used our grad degree to try on a lot of different future careers. So every paper that we had to write, every project we had to do, I tried to consider whether or not I would enjoy doing this for the rest of my life or for a career that could grow and evolve. And I did not like the transmission research I did nearly as much as I thought I would. I kind of came to the conclusion that it was a lot of community engagement that was undermining the ability to build out transmission infrastructure in developed countries. And so I shifted my focus to what I think is a much more challenging community engagement problem, but also one that is equally complex in terms of its ability to be transcending in terms of the topic area, but I switched to the whole mining, processing, refining world and what it means for the energy transition, with aluminum being my baby in that. And I think that it just goes to show that all things have a cost, all energy has a cost. And when you think about the fact that we are transitioning to this renewable based economy, it really means that we are renewable fueled economy. It really means that we are transitioning from a fossil fuel economy into a minerals based economy, because so much of what the clean energy transition demands is going to be fueled by minerals that need to be extracted, crushed, smelted, refined. And there's a whole slew of environmental, social, and governance impact of changing our society to be able to do that effectively, efficiently, sustainably. And so I took the uphill battle of trying to understand what this means for one specific commodity, and that is aluminum, because aluminum has, it's only number 2 to copper in terms of its application as for minerals in the clean energy transition. And so my aluminum boss and I used to always joke about competing with copper for attention, because copper was everybody's favorite child, but it's not, does not have the status of critical mineral on the USGS list. So we have that going for us. But aluminum is used in solar panels, solar photovoltaic cells. It is used in building infrastructure. It actually can be very helpful in decarbonizing buildings, which maybe Amethyst might show me up on her knowledge there. And it's used in the electrification of our transportation systems in terms of the casing of the batteries that we use, the lightweighting of the very heavy battery-based vehicles, and then a multitude of other little things like foils in the batteries themselves. And so that's just to name a few of the applications. But because we are changing our world where these things are going to be much more critical to our day-to-day lives, there are national security implications of where we're getting them. And so that ended up being kind of the focus of the first report, and then it devolved into many other reports, because as research does, you're never able to really stop just there. There's so much more that you can jump into a wonderful rabbit hole and explore. So I'll pause there, because that was kind of a long-winded way to say how I got here, but not necessarily giving you anything to chew on in terms of my findings.
Well, I also think that we'd be remiss not to mention that like aluminum played a big part in you actually graduating, because it constantly held beer for you while we were sitting in class. Every time you would make one of those jokes of just being like, aluminum.
It's so accurate, because I'm an extroverted person, and I did research was not for me, in the sense that it was a lot of late nights motivating myself to really think hard and write and rewrite and rethink and reread. And I had to be motivated by my true passion, which is beer. And so simultaneously was like hurting, because I was like, God damn, this can, the secondary use application case for aluminum. One of our professors actually said that she thinks that we shouldn't, when I vented her about this, that we should not be using aluminum for beer at all, because it undermines the critical importance of the mineral. And so when you have it in that application, people start to think that it's not nearly as important and hard to get, right? It's kind of the cognitive dissonance that end users have. So,
right.
Yeah, very accurate point.
I think that that's like a really important point, though, because even like I bought these, you know, like red solo cups, but they're aluminum instead of plastic, and they, you know, you can just reuse them. And the whole part about them is that they are recyclable. And so it's like a more sustainable option. And so I think that like that is something that consumers relate with aluminum, is that it's this like infinitely recyclable. So, I mean, just like break that down a little bit for the listeners, like what exactly are we talking about here when we're talking about, you know, like the entire topic of your, we're not talking about beer cans. We're not talking about that like third tertiary use of aluminum. Right. We're talking about that primary. How do you get there? And
yeah, I think it's so great, because Amethyst and I spoke at an event at SICE, or at Hopkins, actually, the main campus. And the first question I got was on the secondary applications of aluminum and recycling. And I think that most of the conversations around aluminum do quickly pivot to that, especially in the climate space, where you're just trying to use less and use it more efficiently. And so the reason for that, and a lot of people use this as a great talking point, is that aluminum is an intensive energy user in the primary production process. So to make aluminum, you're getting bauxite, which is, you know, higher up on the surface level of the earth. And so you're able to, you know, pull it out easily. There are some environmental impacts in terms of the red mud that is left over, but we're not as concerned about the bauxite extraction just because it's so plentiful, but you need to transform that initial kind of mined product into alumina, which is refined. And then you take the refined alumina and then you turn it into primary aluminum. And that has a higher purity, and that's more what we're using in these end applications. And then you can have, you'd get transform it into the end application through the downstream part of the supply chain. And so that's the casting and, you know, transforming it into like the building infrastructure that you see, the frame of your car, the hood of your car. And then secondary is when you're reusing those things. And so I think the misconception around secondary aluminum is you already have an incredible amount reused in the specific systems that they're being used in. So, for example, for the automotive sector, it's called a closed loop recycling system, because you essentially are able to capture returns on your investment in terms of getting the aluminum, because you can just reuse it. But there are limitations to the ability to do the circular economy around aluminum, because it's really hard to transform something that was once a car hood into like a building frame, right? So you have to kind of be industry specific in that regard. And this is an area that I actually did not do an incredible amount of research in, but I'm imploring the new program associate who my aluminum boss hired to look into this, because I think it's a beautiful opportunity in terms of policy recommendations that can be both locally specific, country specific, and industry specific that will churn out a lot more. But to go back to your core question about why I didn't focus on that is because, you know, we still need more primary. The World Economic Forum did a report where they said, even if we recycled 100% of the aluminum in use today, the gap in terms of the aluminum we need for the clean energy transition for our 2-degree scenario, which is what we're trying to keep warming at, is still astronomical. Like, I don't remember the exact number, but I remember it being such a jarring amount in terms of the chart of what was needed. And so you still need more. And the other reason you need more, just full stop, because there's not enough in circulation. But the other reason is because you need new aluminum to make the thing, right? Like the secondary product, the recycling of it degrades the material. And so you do need the higher grade material for these end products. And so you need to be able to do more. And then that gets to our major quandary, which my research focused on, is the energy cost of aluminum. There's a huge energy suck that goes into the primary process. And that means that, you know, there's a climate impact. 2% of global climate or global greenhouse gas emissions come from aluminum. But then it also means that these producers of aluminum have to pay a lot for their energy, right? All energy has a cost. Aluminum is being used in different and new energy systems of tomorrow. I mentioned the solar PV cells. Aluminum is like 40 or 87% of a solar PV cell, but it has an energy cost to it as well. And so 40% of the aluminum production cost for primary aluminum, which is that market segment that is the new kind of aluminum coming from the bauxite and alumina, that is energy. So electricity costs. And it varies obviously by region, because there's different electricity costs in different parts of the world. But overall, our research found that it's 40% of the cost to produce it. And that's something that is going to drive markets. I'm a real believer in the ability to kind of move things by the capitalistic goals of the company. And so if you're able to make energy cheaper, maybe by making it renewable, and we've seen penetration rates of renewable energies have actually decreased the costs of, they have become more cost competitive with fossil fuels now. If you can make that business case to be able to deploy solar for an aluminum smelter, being able to still balance the solar energy's intermittency, then that's going to help solve some of the energy cost problems that are affiliated with this. And sorry, I'll stop now again, because I can go on another rant about how that implicates national security, but I appreciate that I am just rambling a little bit.
Abigail, in your report, you examine various policies and practices in like different countries around the world to support the domestic aluminium industries, considering the shared challenges like the energy costs and emissions regulation, so on and so forth. So which one of these policies do you think are most suited and applicable to the United States?
So just for listeners, the report that we're referencing is this new report that we're actually going to be releasing on August 15th. So when you hear this podcast, it'll be out. It's called Global Insights, Energy and Environmental Solutions for Aluminum. And it's the fourth in the series of reports that I did for SAFE's Center on Strategic Industrial Materials. And it really builds upon the case that the United States aluminum production is waning as a result of energy. And so tries to look at the big picture of how, in the face of the U.S. decreasing as a result predominantly of energy costs, but also because of China's market manipulation in terms of their high subsidies in their primary sector, many countries have been able to survive. And so that's because they've employed the policies that Shada mentioned. This includes price pegging for aluminum smelters. So pegging their price with the utility, pegging their aluminum price with the utility's energy cost. And so when one goes up, they flow together. And so you aren't facing this huge gap in between your supply or your biggest cost energy and your production primary aluminum, what you're able to sell it on the market. And so they move together. So when the utility has high energy costs, the price will be higher and they can kind of win together, right? So that one is already being employed in the US market by one smelter in New York State, Messina. It was quite controversial for the state legislature to, and the NYSERDA, the energy arm of the New York State government, to move forward with that. It was the biggest kind of deal that a company of that nature was able to get, but it's proven to make sure that that smelter is not going anywhere. It's been very resilient through the energy crisis of Russia and Ukraine, prompted by the Russia-Ukraine war, and it also has been resilient through other kind of downturns and upturns in energy markets. So that one's already being used, but I do think that it's an important one to consider. There are some drawbacks for the U.S. market on that, but I do think it's kind of proven already in some regards. The other ones we looked at is how you can spur innovation through carbon pricing mechanisms. And so how in global carbon markets that, you know, we don't have a price on carbon in the United States, but Canada has a price on carbon. They have different mechanisms in different provinces.
So do you think the U.S. needs some sort of carbon pricing to...
don't you love how you always like bring our conversation to this climate questions? I'm a realist. Whether or not I think we need a price on carbon, I'm not optimistic that we're going to get one in this Congress or the next Congress or the one after that. And it needs to be congressionally authorized. And so I don't want to like bet my money on that pony, I guess. I think obviously there's major gains, and economists all over the world have proven this. My report somewhat proves it in terms of the innovation it inspires, but I just don't think that we're necessarily going to get it. So I didn't prop it up as the biggest recommendation for the market, but I do think the United States, who sells themselves as this innovation hub for the world in terms of what they're able to do to disrupt the processes that other countries have kind of built their economies around in terms of being able to leapfrog and like innovate, I think that they need to recognize that there are major market movement. There's major market movement happening in other countries that have a price on carbon and inspiring these different aluminum smelters to try to incorporate, whether it's carbon capture, utilization and storage technologies to kind of capture the carbon that aluminum smelting produces. And so just this is also another kind of aluminum rabbit hole. The aluminum smelting process that I mentioned, it's energy intensive because you have to heat up the vats as high as possible. And that's very intensive. But then also the emission side of it, it's not just from the electricity use. It is also from the fact that when you're running the electrical current through the aluminum to kind of break apart the different components, elements, this is where you see I am not a scientist, but it naturally emits carbon dioxide. So how do you capture that? So that's why they're employing this the carbon capture in those facilities. And then the other thing they're doing is trying to change the anode type to be able to emit oxygen, release oxygen as the byproduct, not CO2. And those, you know, are great gains because if you're having these inert anodes incorporated, they have a much longer shelf life than the carbon-based anodes. And so it's a win-win-win. And again, from a market perspective or like a capitalistic perspective, if you can have 15% operational costs slid right off of your balance sheet as a result of incorporating this technology, and then you also have a carbon win, that's great. So I do think that there's something that the U.S. should consider in terms of its inability to kind of move markets by ignoring the fact that there's benefits to having a price on carbon.
Shada, I know that we both agree Abigail's very, very intelligent. But remember, she was wrong about the IRA passing too. So you could still hold out hope. Maybe we'll do it.
That was a tough week for me. Hey, one of the governors, or not governors, one of the senators from Hawaii literally tweeted, nobody saw this coming, like not even the Democrats on the Senate side. So I feel vindicated. But my favorite policy, global policy that I learned about, which is I think maybe a little bit more nascent, so might need, you know, a little more proof in the pudding in terms of whether or not the United States can learn from it, is what Australia is considering and Europe has had some success with in terms of demand response mechanisms So they're using essentially regulations to require that aluminum smelters are able to be a energy sink for the grid. So in moments of high demand, they can curtail. And this requires a different type of smelting process, not a huge change, but certainly not something that maybe our more archaic aluminum smelters that are in some cases over 100 years old can apply. But the ability to kind of like, you know, curtail and then like have that energy available on the grid when everybody's at home running their dishwasher, watching TV, all their lights are on. Maybe it's the middle of winter, you have, you know, the heat going, or it's DC right now and you have like tons of AC going. So the ability to do that, I think, is really important because as we all know, but maybe our listeners don't know, we're plagued with these intermittencies in our different types of renewable energies like wind and solar, where if the sun is not shining or the wind's not blowing, then we're going to have these gaps. And that that requires battery balancing, or maybe it requires a more of an active role that industry, high energy intensive industry, can play in terms of releasing energy that they either have captive or that they buy from the grid back to the grid.
Can I ask another question?
Yeah, please.
Okay, so in one part of your report, you talk about CBAM. So how significant do you think, how significant of an impact do you think the EU Carbon Border Adjustment Mechanism, CBAM, could have on the global trade flows and competitiveness if fully implemented? And could it help level the playing field for the US producers by any chance?
So Europe gets most of its aluminum from Norway. And so I don't think we provide a lot of our primary, I don't remember the exact trade flow number, to Europe. So I don't know if we're going to have as big of an impact. I will tell you that in my third report, which is my favorite of my children, is we focus on the global arrangement of sustainable steel and aluminum. And my understanding is that steel is much more impacted by the CBAM, US steel. And so that's kind of holding up some of the conversations around Europe and the United States' global arrangement on sustainable steel and aluminum, which would ostensibly create a common market for high standard produced aluminum. And so high standard in this sense means, like, obviously it's environmentally conscious. And the other sense of high standard is it's not seeping with like trade manipulations in what China does in terms of over subsidizing with illegal subsidies their aluminum smelters and creating essentially a disadvantage for other aluminum producers to compete in a globalized market. And so that project is like a huge undertaking by both governments in a time that we're not necessarily the most pro-trade universe, I would say. Like, I don't know if I would love to see trade mechanisms used in much more strategic ways as it pertains to the trade flows of clean goods and common markets for clean goods. But I think that we're butting heads a little bit because we still have some growing pains in the 21st century over whether or not we're going to maintain what we've defined in the World Trade Organization and GATT as what, you know, the free and fair trade market can and should look like, because the U.S. continues to maybe skirt away from following the rules of the game, or not following the rules of the game as much as like caring that they exist. And so I think that we have to kind of evolve to make sure that all of these different border adjustments, border taxes, which is what GASA might be, are successfully implemented and seen as viable by industry, because we're also very scared that all of these executive branch decision-making, I mean, this isn't true for Europe necessarily, but certainly for the United States, are going to be whiplashed away if we have a change of government, if we have a President DeSantis or a President Trump, right? And so what happens to these common green markets and the ability to kind of move consumers and suppliers and distributors into using greener goods if we kind of lose steam in a change of government?
I want to refocus this a little bit in like what this looks like in the US in terms of like our smelters. So I know that like you've discussed the Washington State, for example. What was that one, the name of that one?
Intalco is the one that like recently kind of, and yeah, efforts to get it back going kind of died off again.
Right. So this is like, I know that you and I have had sort of some discussions around this, and it's interesting in like this decarbonization space too. I was having conversations today with some of my coworkers about like decarbonization for commercial real estate assets and how we approach that from a grid perspective. Like there can be so much optimism about like the grid decarbonizing, and that's why we shift to this electric, you know, load. But in Washington state, for example, this is a very unique case, right? Like this state has been very aggressive about what their decarbonization goals are going to look like. And they're riding a lot of that on their hydro, which I've talked about a ton. But if you couple that with like the climate impacts of what climate is doing or the climate change is doing to our hydroelectric supply, and then a industry like aluminum in Washington that is such a large energy intensive source, you know, can you just like talk a little bit about what it actually looks like to ensure that this is a viable industry in the U.S. at the same time as we're decarbonizing and having these other broader conversations?
This line that my aluminum boss likes to tout from the group that was trying to resurrect the Intalco smelter is that the United States needs to do what every other country does and support heavy industry, high energy intensive industry, by subsidizing electricity and being able to allow us to compete globally and produce what is ostensibly something, a fuel. Aluminum is used in so many different clean energy applications to be able to produce that. And I don't know. I mean, I think that like, I would love to see more government interventions that don't just result in like blatant subsidies, because I think that, again, it gets back to our problems in terms of what the globalized trade world looks like and how we capitalize on comparative and competitive advantages in a way that makes us extremely efficient and evolving and growing as a global economy. That said, you know, it's really frustrating because the energy that Washington State has available to it, clean energy in the form of hydro, you know, they're going to sell that to somebody else. And it's probably going to be a Bitcoin miner or a data center. And these industry groups, not to knock them, they need to decarbonize as well. And they have the commitments for their decarbonization of their products too. So I get it that they need to do that. But we need to see aluminum as a fuel. We need to be able to prioritize making sure that that fuel is done cleanly so we aren't just entrapping ourselves in an even larger emitting circle, right? And so, and on top of that, and this is what the reports really also try to purport very aggressively, aluminum is a critical infrastructure, right? It's used in critical infrastructure. And so the ability of us to have high amounts of supply and produce it is it enabling our economic security and our national security, right? And so if we just continue to kind of let China, who's already producing 57% of the world's aluminum, dominate, where are we going to get the aluminum we need for our clean energy transition? Where are we going to get it for our digital transition? And then we're going to let like the fact that we're just want a Microsoft data center to get energy to come in the way of our ability to produce what is something necessary for critical infrastructure and clean energy. It seems backwards to me. And so it does seem like we need government intervention to prioritize those dual goals.
The data centers are going to come after us now.
I'm here for it, but I just think that we need more, and we're seeing more renewable energy penetration. So we'll get there, but like, I don't know. If you need energy to produce energy, then you need to be strategic about how you're producing the energy.
So Abigail, the queen of aluminium, what's next for your research?
So, I mean, hopefully I've tied up my aluminum laces. This report that's coming out on August 15th is the fourth and final for me. I know the Center for Strategic Industrial Materials is going to continue doing important research on this. But, you know, I did the energy problem, energy solution for aluminum report, which was the seminal report for that center and kind of laid the foundation for these other reports. I did legislative analysis for the U.S. aluminum industry. So that was Inflation Reduction Act, infrastructure investment, and the bipartisan infrastructure law, the CHIPS and Science Act, and then also kind of the Defense Production Act Title III, which has been reinvoked and authorized funding for in different pockets of government legislation that has passed. And so I did that analysis to kind of see what the impacts to the U.S. aluminum industry was and how it kind of dealt with this energy problem, energy solution situation. And then my trade report that I said is my favorite child, and then my global report that I think is my second favorite. Maybe they're my twins. So I feel like I've done a lot on the aluminum stuff. I used it to get my job at the Center for Strategic, for the Center for Critical Minerals Strategy at SAFE, at the same organization. And so I'm ready to kind of broaden my understanding in terms of these similar energy problem, energy solution issues that other mineral commodities have. And so I'm excited to kind of see where that takes me. And hopefully, you know, move some other markets in that regard. But we'll see. Stay tuned, I guess.
If anyone can do it, you can.
Yeah. Go, Abigail.
Right. That's a wrap for today's episode. Hopkins Green Tea is brought to you by Shada Hushmandi, Abigail Hunter, Leonie Hikita, and Amethyst Devlin, all alumni of the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. For more information on the podcast, visit SAIS Perspectives website or follow us on LinkedIn and Twitter using @HopkinsGreenTea, all in one word, as the handle. Thanks, and until next time, goodbye.